Hello and welcome to Knowledge Engaged, the podcast of the University of Nottingham's Institute for Policy and Engagement. The Knowledge Engaged podcast is an opportunity to explore with our researchers the work they're doing and the difference it's making. I'm Stephen Meek, Director of the Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Peter Chapman. Peter is an Associate Professor in the School of Psychology here at the University. He's a cognitive psychologist who specialises in the psychology of vision and memory. One of the areas where he applies this knowledge is driving as part of the accident research unit here at the university. He explores how we process visual and other cues when we are driving and how driving can be made safer as a result. He's worked closely with the Department for Transport. His insights have shaped changes to the highway code here and in other countries too. So, hi Peter.
Hi Stephen.
I just wondered, what was your, if you can briefly summarise your kind of research journey to where you are now looking at accidents?
Thank you. Well, yes. I mean, I've been doing research in this sort of area for almost 30 years now, so it's been a long journey. I started off doing a PhD in Cambridge on the psychology of risk. And it turned out that the area that most people experience their biggest risks in every life is just driving to work. And if you look at the number of deaths involved on British roads, you discover this is a very, very significant risk. Broadly, I've spent most of my career looking at the way the crashes that happen on British roads are caused by human error. It's trying to understand what it is that we could do differently to prevent all those deaths. And it's turned out that the answer is very, very complex and depends on all sorts of different components of human psychology. So I started thinking I was interested in the psychology of risk, and then I discovered to get anywhere near answering this question, you've got to understand all sorts of aspects of human psychology. And as you mentioned, I've been particularly looking at the cognitive side of things, the way we take in visual information, the way we remember it, the way we process it.
So originally your approach was thinking that actually, in a sense, we're making sort of poor judgments about our ability to do things.
So I started with the idea that people chose to take risks.
Yeah.
So young drivers were essentially maniacs who couldn't be trusted and were running through red lights and crashing into things. There is some truth in that. But the insight that I soon got is that no one intends to have a road crash. So even if you've chosen to drive above the speed limit, you're not doing it because you want to crash. You generally think you're invulnerable. You think that you've got the situation under control. And if you do crash, it's a mistake. It's an error, either in not understanding your lack of skill or some aspect of the situation that you just hadn't understood. And you've taken a risk by mistake, not deliberately, generally.
That's really interesting. So can you give us an example?
Well, some of the first research I did at the University of Nottingham was funded by the Department for Transport, looking directly at young drivers, because young drivers do have a lot more crashes than older, more experienced drivers. And the first question was, why? Well, to try to explore that, we gave our young drivers lots of questionnaires. We got them out on the roads. We got them driving. We recorded their eye movements to see what they looked at. We got them doing all sorts of psychological tests. And I'd assumed that we'd find them driving much more dangerously than the more experienced drivers. The shock was, if anything, they were safer in the way they drove. So with me sitting in the back of the car watching someone, and we were talking to people who'd literally just passed their driving tests. So
you're a brave man, Peter, a very brave man.
Well, no, I recruited these from driving test centres. Literally, you know, as they got there, you've passed. They also got a questionnaire and they met me and kind of, you know, come in next week and drive our instrumented vehicle around Nottingham. And I was expecting them to be terrifying drivers. And we compared them with people who are 5 to 10 years more older and more experienced, whom we know have much lower crash rates. But these newly qualified drivers, they tend to drive slowly and carefully. They remained beautifully in lane. They kept a long way from the vehicle in front of them. and they never went anywhere near the speed limit. Whereas the slightly more experienced drivers were much closer to the vehicle ahead. They cut corners. They were over the speed limit most of the time. And that came as a real shock to me. It wasn't that the young drivers were behaving like idiots and old drivers were more law-abiding. If anything, it was exactly the opposite. And that's the first big realization that this was going to be more complex and much more nuanced than I'd realized. We did find some differences. The differences particularly came in the eye movements in terms of where the different drivers looked. And you could tell from the experience that the more older, experienced drivers looked in all the right places when they were driving. So they were taking risks, but they were very measured risks in that they knew where danger might come from and they were monitoring it very, very carefully. Whereas the newly qualified drivers, yes, they were driving below the speed limit, but they tended to be looking just straight ahead. And there were moments that were quite terrifying because you're sitting in the back of the car monitoring this person's eye movements and you can see them coming onto the ring road about to pull across. And you know they haven't looked in their blind spot. They haven't looked behind them. And there were some clear skills missing that still had to be taught, which was a surprise. That wasn't what we'd expected.
That's really interesting. So in effect, they were driving in the way they'd been taught to drive and were highly compliant. But there was a whole skill set that they hadn't, that you absorbed by experience. What were the lessons for that from the Department for Transport? Were there any actions as a result?
Well, the immediate change was the Department for Transport, at that point, the Driving Standards Agency, agreed to change the guidelines around the driving test. So typically, you're quite worried about how scary and dangerous it is running driving tests. So a lot of driving tests actually avoid things like dual carriageways. Mm-hmm. Now, given we'd specifically noticed that these newly qualified drivers didn't seem to know where to look when they were changing lanes, and some related work I've been doing in Cambridge had shown that actually you could get to the point of taking your driving test having never overtaken anything other than a stationary vehicle at any point, it became clear that we had to find ways to make the driving test more challenging. So the immediate change was the advice that wherever possible, all driving tests now have to include some dual carriageway driving. So they shook up all their routes to try to find more places that would actually represent the problems newly qualified drivers have, with the idea that that would encourage training, that driving instructors, if they know the test is going to involve the dual carriageway, will spend much more time teaching on dual carriageways and getting the relevant skills in there.
That brings back a horrifying memory of the day after I passed my driving test a very long time ago, taking the slip road onto the M1 and just feeling like I was going into shark infested waters rather than something I knew how to do. No, that's fascinating. And also really a sort of wonderful example there as well of the way research can impact policy by saying, well, actually, we're looking at this through the wrong lens. We're looking at this in the wrong way. You know, we think we know the problem we're addressing, but actually the issue is something completely different. That's sort of fascinating thing there. So perhaps we can turn now to the most recent piece of work that you have been working on, which is the Sea Bike, Say Bike campaign. Can you say a bit about the sort of roots of that and what's happening with it?
Okay, so where does this one come from? Obviously, any crash is a very, very bad thing. But there are some sorts of crashes that I find particularly problematic. Now, one thing that is very obvious in the crash statistics in the UK is that motorcyclists are massively overrepresented. So a motorcyclist, based on the most recent crash statistics, is of something about like 50 times more likely to be killed per mile they drive on British roads than a car driver. That's an absolutely huge difference, 50 times more likely. And I'd pretty much assumed that that was because motorcyclists were taking risks. They were just kind of, you know, driving way above the speed limit on dangerous roads. A little bit of that happens, but we did a very large study with Nottinghamshire Police looking at the kind of crashes that motorcyclists are actually involved with. And David Clark, who was the leader on that research, came up with a categorization of the kind of crashes, which pretty clearly pointed out that in about half of the crashes where a motorcycle's involved, they weren't at fault. Now, at that point, my attitude changed quite remarkably in that, yes, if a motorcyclist chooses to drive at 130 miles an hour on a bendy road and get themselves killed, I'm prepared to shrug and say that was a risk they chose. But a lot of these fatal accidents, kind of more than 100 every year, are ones where the motorcyclist was doing nothing wrong, where they were driving along within the speed limit, minding their own business, usually with their headlights on, wearing a high visibility jacket, and a car pulled out in front of them. That's a particularly awful crash because the motorcyclist could have done nothing about it. But it's actually so common that motorcyclists have a special name for them. They call these things, these events, when they survive them, they call them SMIDZIs. So SMIDZI stands for sorry, mate, I didn't see you. And that's what the driver says as they pick up the motorcyclist from the floor. Yes. Obviously, that's an awful crash and it causes a lot of deaths. But psychologically, it's a bit of a mystery. Why would a car driver pull out into a road in front of an oncoming motorbike?
Yeah.
You can see it's a pure error. In the vast majority of cases, if the car driver could have had their time again, they would have never pulled out. They made a mistake. Traditionally, we've assumed it's because the car driver didn't look in the right places. They didn't look for a motorbike. They never made the right head movements and they just pulled out, not knowing the motorbike was there. And I was very interested in that. And we have some fantastic driving simulators here at Nottingham. So I tried to simulate that sort of crash. So I had lots of drivers in our driving simulator pull out into junctions time and time and time again. And every now and again, motorcyclists would be coming at them. And I recorded their eye movements so I could see exactly what they looked at. Mm-hmm. Well, just occasionally, they wouldn't look at the motorbike.
Yeah.
Fair enough. That's clearly a problem. But much more commonly, we found that people would look at the motorbike and still pull out in front of it. Now, that was a real surprise. What's going on? Actually, that does accord with what motorcyclists say. He looked right at me and then he pulled out. Well, that feels like a real psychological mystery. What's going on there? The insight I had is that actually it's not as simple as just looking. As a cognitive psychologist, you've got to make a decision based on multiple sources of evidence. Now, the thing about driving is there is stuff going on all around you. There's stuff to your right, stuff to your left, stuff straight ahead. If you're going to look around, you've not only got to see stuff, you've got to remember it as well. And it turned out, to my great surprise, that if we started giving people memory tests in the simulator, so we'd get them coming up to a junction, we'd find them looking at something, and then we'd switch the simulator off, and we'd just say, okay, what was around you at that moment? It turned out that very often people would look at something, and then a few seconds later, they wouldn't remember it was there, which created the surprising idea that actually memory may be just as important as vision in these sorts of crashes. Why is that important? When you get the psychology underlying it right, you suddenly have all sorts of new ideas about how you might prevent them. So up till now, all the safety advice is focused on looking for bikes.
There
are lots of campaigns trying to make people more aware of motorcyclists. Well, the surprise for me was that you may need to do more than just look at the bike. You need to make sure you remember it as well.
Yeah.
And of course, this is where the See Bike, Say Bike campaign comes in. It comes from something very specific we know about short-term memory based on work done in Cambridge in the 1960s. Actually, we have two sorts of short-term memory. We've got short-term memory for visual things and a completely different short-term memory for sounds and words. And you've got a separate capacity in each of those systems. What we've been proposing is that if you're at a junction and you're looking around and you see a bike coming at you, that can be a motorbike or a pedal cycle, if you just say bike out loud, that will put it in your verbal short-term memory. That means that if you then look a few other places and see another car and things, that new information won't overwrite your memory for the bike. So at the point you make the decision, you won't have forgotten it.
And presumably that was then borne out in further testing on the simulator, was it?
Exactly. Now, the problem with this kind of thing is, at the moment, this is still something we've shown in the simulator, we've shown in the laboratory. It works beautifully in the laboratory. So your problem now is, how do we get to the policy stage? How do we actually test this on real roads? It turns out to be very, very difficult. The reason for that is, you know, the number of motorcyclists dying on British roads is terrifying. But it's still only around 100 each year in a crash like this.
Yeah.
You can't be there at the time it happens. You can't get there in advance. If these things happened every time people came to a junction, there would be hundreds of thousands of deaths. It's still a rare event. It's a horrible, expensive, terrible event, but it's very difficult to research on the roads.
Yeah.
So at the moment, all the research is still in the laboratory. We've demonstrated in principle how it happens, and we've demonstrated how we can stop it in the laboratory. We're now at the stage of trying to think, okay, how can we turn that into a proper road safety campaign? And then how can we check if it's working? Because this is one of the great problems in policy. And I'm sure you've heard the arguments about the difference between evidence-based policy and policy-based evidence.
Oh, yes. I've been guilty of a bit of it as myself. Yeah.
Well, one of the great problems is it's so easy to come up with a brilliant policy and then go looking for evidence to support it. And I've been involved in a number of research studies that I'm afraid were a bit like that. And I found the funders have been astonishingly unhappy when I've sought the evidence out. And it turns out the evidence shows that our ideas were wrong.
Mm.
But that's what science is about. It's about testing hypotheses. It's not about proving them. And you've got to remember that. So I do not yet know whether C-bike, Say-bike will work. I've got good sound theoretical reasons thinking it might. I've got pretty good reasons to be confident that it at least won't make things worse.
Yeah.
And will probably make it better. But it won't be until you can actually get some really large scale, properly funded trials with proper follow-ups of crash rates, crash types, that you can actually test that kind of hypothesis. And that's a big, long project.
Have you got some interest in the project from people?
So I've got a lot of interest. So at the moment, the Department for Transport are funding a small-scale test of this in pedestrians. So the logic is exactly the same. When you cross the road, you look right, you look left. Hey, maybe you've forgotten what you saw when you looked right by the time you made the decision. So they've funded a small-scale study over the next 18 months to explore whether we can use this kind of training to make pedestrians safer at crossing the road.
Yeah.
That's easier. We can do that kind of experiment faster and test it out. And of course, it also relates to some of the Department for Transport's current priority groups. So actually, it's much easier to get funding for work on cyclists and pedestrians than it is on car drivers and motorcyclists, for reasons I'm sure you're aware of.
And presumably, one of the things you want to test, that if that is the way the memory works when you're driving a car, then it probably works in a similar way when you're deciding to cross the road.
The logic is there. I'm being a little bit cautious because haven't got the data yet. Yeah. So at the moment, extending it to pedestrians is just an idea. I hope by autumn to be able to say, yes, memory is a problem with pedestrians. And I hope in 18 months' time to also have tested out a C-bike, Say-bike style intervention, which hopefully will show that at least in controlled conditions, pedestrians are safer if they use it. So that's the current timescale. And then, of course, you've got the, okay, well, how would you move that out into education?
That's really fascinating. And I think, you know, really admirable as well, the way that you're rigorously applying the scientific method here. You're not just saying, look, I've got this idea. It works in theory. You must do it everywhere now. But you're actually saying, no, I think this probably works. But let's make sure.
I have to admit, that comes with experience.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are the lessons here for others trying to make their way in influencing policy?
I'm afraid you need a lot of experience of being wrong. I know when I started in my research career, I thought it was terribly, terribly important to be right. And I put an awful lot of effort into being right. With time, I have learned that no, it's not about having the right answer. It's about having the right questions. Mm. Now, if you come up with good, interesting questions, you should be doing research that tests those questions. And I've got into the habit, whenever I start a project, I draw a graph of what I think the results will be. And I do it honestly, based on theory and understanding. This is what I think we'll find. Now, I've done enough research projects that I've been able to compare the graphs I drew before the experiment with what we actually got when we finished it. And I am afraid there are very few that match.
Yes.
So I have a beautiful record of being repeatedly wrong. Knowing that I might be wrong has really focused me on asking questions that I want to know the answer to. And it doesn't matter what the answer is. I just want to know either way. Because one of the things we're very bad at is recording and publicising our wrong answers. And this is a problem in road safety research. People make the same mistakes again and again and again. And you can see over the years, people come up with great ideas, try them, they don't work, they bury the evidence that it didn't work, and they come back 10 years later and try it all over again. I think if there's one thing I would do to improve road safety policy, it would be to have a much better record of all the failed intervention with plenty of detail, and to really encourage people to celebrate failure so that we can learn from it.
That's such an interesting point, and, you know, one from which I think policymakers can learn too. You know, so often you reinvent the idea that thinks that it just feels like it ought to work, rather than sort of look back at the evidence base. And there is that human nature as well, that, you know, if you've had the idea, you've put the investment in, you really want it to work. And it's very hard to sort of face up to that, you know, the fact of the scientific method that a negative result is as useful as a positive one.
More useful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a road safety perspective, yeah, one of the surprises is over the years, people are always coming up with advanced driver training programs for people after their driving tests. There are all sorts of variants of them. Almost always, when those are carefully evaluated, you discover they don't actually reduce crash rates. Unfortunately, I've watched several of these schemes being very carefully evaluated, and then you can still find the evidence, but you really, really have to look. You need to know it's there before you can actually discover, published in an obscure conference proceeding somewhere, is a massive study on advanced driver training showing really quite clearly that it hasn't made anyone any safer. But everyone expects it to.
Yeah. No, it's very, very interesting. Look, Peter, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Thank you for listening to the Knowledge Engaged podcast. If you want to find out more about Peter's work, there will be some links in the notes to this podcast. So I just want to say thanks again to Peter, and thanks to everyone for listening to this podcast.